Good afternoon. My name is Chris Lydon, host of the Open Source. Susan Faludi is our star. but let me just say, maybe put it to you, Susan, that it's beginning to seem like there's only one story in the world that we can even think about, and it has everything to do with male and female and the passages between, but also, I mean, from who remembers Bruce Caitlin Jenner? I mean, that was one milestone. The Transparent series was another. And there are innumerable symptoms of this, what we're going through. But I louder. Yeah. I can talk louder, but maybe the machine can get louder, too. I would just say this is the book to begin with, and it's extraordinarily rich, multidimensional, and the rest is details. Susan.
Thank you so much. I love that we're in a church.
Remember when you say safe as a church, you know?
I'm sorry?
The cliche was as safe as a church. Oh, well, here we are.
Yeah, well, we're not safe. That's for sure. I don't know that we'll be safe on November 9th either, but we'll see. So I think what we're going to do is I'm going to talk at you for about 10 minutes and do a very, very short little reading, and then we're going to gab, and then I guess you all will ask questions. To start with, this is not where I ever expected to be. I never expected or even aspired to write a memoir. I've always stuck to writing about public and political issues, and always with that journalist remove. Despite my feminist bona fides, the personal for me has always been personal. And then I got an email in 2004 that made that separation impossible to maintain. So let me get to that email in a moment, but here's what happened. I found myself in a situation where the issues that I've long weighed in on, feminism, sex roles, gender identity, became issues that I couldn't begin to think about, much less write about, without admitting to my own experience. I kind of had to write a memoir or give up writing. So In the Dark Room is a real departure for me. And it gave me pause when one early and very nice review in The Guardian remarked, quote, "The emotional incontinence and narcissism that pass for insight and power in memoirs these days is not for Faludi. Being interested in facts, she is unlikely to play the dubious trump card of personal experience." And I thought, really? Because I thought I was so self-exposing. I talk about my father's violence to our family and to me as a kid. And I relate my father's story through my own personal reactions, which a good deal of the time involved me being rather surly or whiny or not particularly attractive. And what's not emotionally incontinent about that? But it got me thinking about what I myself look for as a consumer of memoirs, which is an element that goes beyond the I. To kind of misparse the word memoir itself, what I'm seeking as a reader is the element of memoir that goes beyond, more me to more than me. And I think about the memoirs of by the authors who are speaking here today, and I think about the memoirs that inspired me while I was working on this book, and they're all more than the authors. To just give you a couple examples of books that guided me while I was writing, Gregor von Rosori's The Snows of Yesteryear, which tells the story of his once aristocratic family as a way of pondering the lost world of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, or J.R. Ackerley's My Father and Myself, about the secret life of his father, which is also about the toll of a sexually repressed society. Or Daniel Mendelsohn's The Lost, about his relatives killed in the Holocaust, whose subtitle, A Search for Six of the 6 Million, crystallizes exactly what I admire in a memoir, that quest for the historically immense through the personally intimate. Here's another way to describe my ideal memoir, and it seems appropriate given that my father was a photographer, and in particular, a photographer whose specialty was altering images. A lot of memoirs these days, to use the popular lingo, are selfies. But what I'm looking for in a memoir, to use another au courant term, is a photo bomb. You know, that is that kind of carefully composed portrait in which something has gone unexpectedly and outrageously awry, a kind of selfie into which a foreign element has intruded. You could say that In the Dark Room began with a literal photo bomb. That email I received in 2004 from my father, which was titled Changes. And it began, "Dear Susan, I've got some interesting news for you. I've decided that I have had enough of impersonating a macho aggressive man that I've never been inside." Well, this interesting news, illustrated by a series of attached selfies, was that my father, without telling anyone in the family, had flown to Thailand a month earlier for sex reassignment surgery. And naturally, this surprised me. Also, understand my father at the time was 76 years old. And also, we had been estranged. My father and I had barely spoken in more than a quarter century, primarily because my father was indeed a macho, aggressive man, as well as domineering, despotic, and when that didn't work, physically violent, all of which fueled my early feminism. In the phone call that eventually followed the email, my father invited me to write her story. And so a couple of months later, I jumped on a plane to Hungary, which was where my father was living. In 1990, my father had returned to the country where she had grown up as a boy. So on that first visit and subsequent ones, we pursued the process of getting to know each other again. And this book is the story of my father's transition and our reconciliation, such as it was a pretty zigzaggy affair. But it's also a story that unfolds on a much larger landscape. Because when I went to Hungary, I was faced with another photo bomb. Into this intimate portrait I was intending to draw of my father intruded the specter of Hungary's neo-fascism, which could not be removed from the frame of my father's life. At the same time that my father was struggling with her gender, Hungary was going through its own identity crisis, one that has unleashed a truckload of authoritarianism, xenophobia, and anti-Semitism. One thing my book tries to do is grapple with the Janus-faced nature of identity. Identity can be a source of liberation when it's based on self-discovery, self-understanding, as it is with LGBT rights, civil rights, feminism, or it can be grounds for oppression when it's used to deny reality and to retreat into a fantasy realm. And what I saw in Hungary was a nation eager to use a concocted Magyar identity to paper over its real and difficult problems and to avoid reckoning with a very dark past, most especially to avoid facing up to its role in the Holocaust, in which it was complicit, avidly so, in the murder of more than 500,000 of its Jewish citizens. This was a past that had profound consequences for my father and my Hungarian Jewish family. My father grew up Orthodox Jewish, then István Friedman, an only child of wealthy parents in Budapest, and lived a life of privilege until World War II, when large numbers of my family would perish in the Holocaust. My teenage father survived by his wits on the streets of Budapest, passing as a Christian with false identity papers and a stolen fascist armband. And one time he would use that armband to pose as a Hungarian Nazi Aircross officer to rescue his parents from a protected house whose residents were about to be killed. Now, no doubt this traumatic boyhood contributed in very complicated ways to the woman my father became. One thing I found in confronting my father's story is the way that an identity is not standalone. The question at the heart of every memoir is the question of identity. People often see identity as singular and stable, but what I saw with my father was an identity that was multiple and fluid, and shaped by her past as much as her present. Anytime you try to talk about one form of identity as if it were separate and distinct, you kind of get photobombed by all the other aspects of identity that combine with it. So to show you what I mean, I'd like to just read a very short segment, 5 minutes, that suggests how history intrudes on one very personal story. Because for my father, her identity as a woman was inseparable from her identity as a Jew. So let me just... There we go. I need my glasses. "I love this place," my father declared. "It's authentic Hungarian." We were waiting for a table at the Fish Farm Inn, close to the Danube, where my father liked to order the halászlé, a traditional spicy fish soup larded with enough paprika to burn out your brain on the first sip. My father especially loved the old-school waiters, elderly gents with formal manners, greeting her with courtly gallantry and pulling out her chair, addressing her with that vintage salutation of men to women. "Kese choklam," which means, "I kiss your hand." Did they find her womanly? As usual, she wasn't wearing a wig. Her white purse was slung like a sailor's duffel over her blue double-breasted captain's jacket, an ocean-faring motif for a seafood dinner. When the waiter left the table, I remarked on his deference. "Well," my father said, "they have to kiss my hand now." "Why?" "Because," she said, "I'm tough." I decided to exercise some toughness of my own. I announced I was foregoing the fish soup. "It's made the correct way here," my father insisted, and proceeded to wear me down with one of her characteristic free-floating filibusters. "Halászlé should only be made with river fish. Or lake fish, but never salt water. It can be carp, perch, catfish. Now, Lake Balatone's the largest freshwater lake, and..." I said I'd try the soup. The waiter arrived with a cast iron kettle and began ladling out its contents, starting with my father's bowl. "Ladies first," my father quipped. She looked pleased with her own sophistry, a trickster mocking and simultaneously enforcing convention. "Lake Balatone," she said after a while. "That's how we ended up hearing it on the radio." A conversation with her was like a ride in a run-amok submersible. One minute you were bobbing on the surface, the next trawling the ocean floor. Now she was back in the summer of 1944 when my fugitive father and grandfather hid in a doctor's apartment while the doctor holidayed at Lake Balatone. Father and son had listened very quietly to the BBC. "That's how we heard the Germans had taken away the Jews of Kasha," my father said now. She was referring to my grandfather's hometown. "My father started to cry," my father said. "He told me, they have killed my parents." "Did he try to get his parents out?" I asked. My father studied the tablecloth and said nothing. "You did something," I said. "You saved your parents." "That was different," my father said. "I believed it, so they believed it." By they, my father was referring to the Hungarian Nazi Aerocross who were guarding the building where my grandparents were held. "I took part in their game," my father said. "If you believe you are whoever you pretend to be, you're halfway saved. But if you act funny, if you act afraid, you're halfway to the gas chamber." My father ordered dessert, pureed chestnuts laced with rum and vanilla, heaped with whipped cream, and served in a gigantic goblet. My father was a lifelong sugar fanatic and always at precise moment in the afternoon. "This role-playing during the war," she said as she tackled the towering confection, "that was a similar process." "Similar to what?" I said. "I could sit down with anyone now, and he kisses my hand," she said. "It strengthened me for life that I did these things back then, and that I could get away with it. So now I can do this other thing," meaning her change in sex. "Because if you are convinced that you are this other person, everybody else will be convinced." "So what you're doing now," I asked, "is that playing another quote-unquote role too?" "I was role-playing as a man," she said. "Now, as a woman, I'm not role-playing anymore." "Because this is who you were all along?" I asked. "Well, it's who I am now," she said. "Since the operation, I have developed another personality." "Which has been easier for you," I asked, "to be accepted as a woman after being born a man, or to be accepted as a Hungarian after being born a Jew?" My father thought about it, holding her spoon before her like a hand mirror. "As a woman," she said, "because I am a woman, with a birth certificate that says I'm a woman, so I must be a woman." My father polished off her dessert. "So," she said, "is the Inquisition over now? The lives and crimes of Stephanie Faludi, oh my God." We filed out into the night air. The Danube lay before us, obsidian in darkness. My father tugged at my sleeve. "Getting away with it," she said. "Susan, don't forget that line. That's the key to it all, because a lot of people got discovered that they were Jewish and they were shot." So. Thank you.
Susan, thank you for this book. I almost want to quibble with you about memoir, because to me this is an enormous piece of reporting, original journalism. It's not summoning up your memory. It's incredible interviewing and exploration, but leaving that aside, I want to sort of start where we ended the last time we talked about this book, which is it's only a piece of it, but the strange fact that your father went through unbelievable introspection and surgery and travel and then revelation, and in some degree came out very much the way he had been. Even in the pictures, he looks, the best one in The Guardian, I think, she looks like himself. As you say, filibusters, a trickster, both remote and distant, and in some sense, down-putting, at the same time, intrusive, bossy, a little on the arrogant side. What does this tell us about the self that's much deeper than gender, perhaps?
Well, it's complicated because, at the heart of this book is this question of what is identity? You know, is it what we choose, or is it the very thing we can't escape? And, you know, like all chicken and egg questions, it's actually both. Yes, you know, my father remained that familiar, very volatile, very complicated, very enigmatic, and very angry, kind of smoldering person on one level. Although I have to say, at the same time, over time, and, you know, I can't go back and do the experiment and find out, well, maybe just over time, if we had reconnected for other reasons and had been grappling with my father's story, maybe my father would have unfolded in a similar way. But I don't think so. I think actually my father's declaration that I'm going to be a woman also allowed her in some sense to reconstruct her past, not obviously entirely. None of us unfortunately get to do that. Whether it's, you know, 20 years of therapy or you know, some other method. But my father began to open up in not, you know, a bit, not a lot, but that was, for my father, a great blessing. And she said to me over and over again that she felt that she could, you know, she couldn't communicate as a man, was the way she put it. You know, somebody else might have taken a different path to breaking that down.
But does she? In other words, I mean, did you ever say, did you ever think of saying, Dad, I'm hearing the same father I knew back home in the old days? In some sense, his temperament, his personality, and maybe something even deeper hadn't been changed at all.
Well, you know, none of us change entirely, and my father changed a small amount, but for my father to change at all was dramatic. And it didn't, I mean, what I'm talking about is something that happened quite late into our, you know, reconnection. So it was really just the, you know, last couple of years before my father died. And a lot of that was, we had the struggle throughout, right from the beginning. I wanted to hear about my father's past, and my father wanted to talk at the beginning just about, you know, her transformation on the gender front. And anytime I tried to bring up the past or say, let's go look at, you know, the synagogue you went to as a child, let's go see your school, my father would say, oh, that's irrelevant, it's ancient history, that's not who I am anymore. But toward the very end, my father turned back to her past. And I like to think that maybe part of that was a byproduct of my pushing on that door so many times. And we ultimately, you know, my father decided, because I never was able to actually coerce my father into doing anything my father didn't want to do. We wound up going back to my father's synagogue, and then this very heavy-duty experience just the year before my father died, where my father discovered that a Reform synagogue had set up in the very building where my father grew up in Pest. And when we went there, we discovered, and you know, this is why I love nonfiction and would never turn to fiction, because I couldn't make this up, or it wouldn't be believable if I did, that the apartment where the synagogue was, because it was a very tiny synagogue, very tiny membership, was this very apartment where my father and grandfather hid in the summer of 44.
Sounds like a detail, but it's not. Take apart, if you will, Susan, this photography as a metaphor of everything. It's astonishing to discover that he was not only a photographer and worked in photography, but in we'd call it today photoshopping, changing photographs, right. polishing them.
Before the days of Photoshop.
Yeah, but it was, of course, a big part of advertising, commercial art, making things seem either better than they were, but all about presentation. Mm-hmm. And that thread defines, in a certain sense, his situation.
Yes, hence the title. Very.
Yeah. In the dark room, literally.
And, you know, I mean, my father literally spent then his life in the dark room.
And very successfully and well-known and an important man in that biz.
My father did a lot of work for my father's main client. This is back in the 70s, 80s, was Condé Nast. And he did, you know, montages, color conversions, reproducing, you know, a print where the negatives had been lost. So he'd make as the art director at the time, and Condé Nast, who I interviewed, said, you know, your father could make a copy so you couldn't tell the difference between the original and the print, which, of course, I lapped up as like, oh, metaphor. I mean, also, my father was great at dodging and masking, which are these photographic techniques. And, you know, but on the more metaphorical level, my father lived in this very sort of unilluminated dark room much of her life. And, you know, after the operation and my father's decision to bring me back into her life, that allowed me, you know, to open up the door a little bit and bring, I hope, some light in.
Another thought. We've spoken about the sort of the obnoxious qualities that persisted, but I want you to speak of the powerful character that persisted. I mean, this is an amazingly resourceful man who could play, who survived because he could play a different role in Nazi Hungary. He went first to Brazil. He came back to the States eventually. But this is a man who struggles, who's deeply willful and persistent and strong. What does that tell us? I mean, there's some wonderful qualities inside that prickly guy.
Well, my father, you know, I mean, my father really was a kind of trickster and survived by tricking, by, you know, by dodging and masking. And that began, well, very early, I mean, most dramatically in the rescue of his parents, and then also, as it turned out, his uncle, who was also being held by the Arrow Cross, and my father again, you know, marched in with this armband, and which was just remarkable. I mean, my father told me the story in very brief form when I was young, and I always was sort of suspicious of it. It just seemed too dramatic. And then when I was researching this book, I went to Israel to see my, you know, sort of far-flung relatives, all of whom my father had cut herself off from. My great aunt and another great aunt or second cousin and great aunt were confirmed the story of my father rescuing his parents, and one of them was actually in the room when it happened. But then my father went on to sort of do this again and again. I mean, he got out of Hungary by inventing, this is right after the war, inventing this story that he was making a movie for the Danish Red Cross, and if they just drove him to, you know, took him back to Copenhagen, that he would make this film out. And he had a camera, but he didn't have any film in it. And he's like, and then he forged a visa, made up a whole stamp so he could get to Brazil, and then made up another one for a friend of his. So every step of the way, you know, sort of getting away with it has, you know, made my father land on his feet.
What was my next thought? and now it's gone right out of my brain. But
it's probably
no. I just want to say the trick in life today is to say anything without mentioning you know who. But I want to say going back in your earlier books, Backlash, and then the one about men, Stift. You've been at this for a while now, and all of these issues are, you know, they have this volcanic power in this country. Something historic is boiling up here. Mm-hmm. Relate all of this to what the country is being forced to deal with, and probably, you know, in the end, let's hope some salutary effect.
Well, you know, I mean, it feels like the culmination of, so I hope it's the culmination, and it probably isn't. It's probably going to keep on going on and getting worse. But of, you know, sort of a historic gender drama that's been going on for at least 20 years, where this so-called, you know, angry white men, I mean, people who are rightly angry about the ways that economic and social change has marginalized them, or who should be angry at the way that the Republicans have sort of right-wing forces have undercut them at every turn, instead have been, you know, manipulated by the right into believing that you know, their problems can be laid at the footstep of minorities and women, and particularly women embodied by Hillary Clinton. I mean, I think back to when I was working on Stift in the 90s, and the sort of marginalized men that I interviewed over and over again would bring up Hillary Clinton, how she was, you know, the power behind the throne, and she was the one really calling the shots. You know, I mean, this is back when she was first lady. And just all of this rage toward her. So now here we are in 2016, and it just, as you said, I mean, it feels like it's just finally erupted on the surface.
Well, but for me, one of the many connections to be drawn is that here we have a situation where, according to Nate Silver's maps, if only men voted, this would be a landslide for Donald Trump, even now. If only women voted, it would be virtually 100% electoral college for Hillary. I mean, we are on the verge of an unbelievable showdown. At the same time, so many trends, the transparent trend, but even your father's discovery that it's a hairline's difference. And it's a holographic mystery. What is the difference between the essential male and the essential female? How do we use those two totally different points of view to forge something in the way of understanding, self-understanding, too.
Well, I think, I mean, in a way, it goes back to what I was saying about identity being, you know, having these two faces that, and so for women who are saying, you know, forget it, we're not going back to the days of, you know, putting up with some, you know, creep who's trying to grope me, that, you know, this is not, this, I don't recognize this as the identity of womanhood anymore. And, you know, on the other side, I think that, I mean, one way of looking at Trump is it's the right taking, adopting the identity politics that were, you know, maybe first pioneered on the left, in that so many of his supporters, I identify with. They want, you know, they want a figure who is the figure that they want to be, this powerful, famous celebrity who, you know, keeps his women in their place, and, you know, who stands up to mom in the figure of Hillary Clinton. And they, you know, they're willing to do that to get that kind of identity jolt, of, you know, having someone to demonize and feeling good about themselves by proxy, rather than have a candidate who actually might make some policy changes that would bring them some agency and authority and maybe even some power into their own personal lives.
That's the political reading of it, but I'm also thinking of sort of the personal readings that people make of it. And this is going to sound really silly, but what if Donald Trump sends his kids a letter from Budapest someday and says, I've been to Thailand. No, but I mean it seriously in the sense that he collapses in chagrin about all this crazed acting out he's been doing on some sort of made-up model of what a guy is supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And what if all of us have got to learn, no, it's incredibly buried and mysterious and ambivalent and may change from one decade to another. And so let's tear down the stereotypes, all of us. And that sounds too goody-goody, but what if that your father's turmoil is happening in half the population, male and female?
What if it were?
Who the hell am I and why am I acting this way, right. Male or female, in stereotypical or inherited or self-promoting ways in a phony identity?
Well, we would have to have some self-inspection, which I'm not expecting from Donald Trump. I mean,
I'm thinking of the rest of us, really.
I'm having a kind of fantasy about that. That would be wonderful. But I think that's, this goes to what I was saying about identity politics, that until we're willing to really examine why we are, sort of reflexively drawn toward a particular figure instead of are willing to separate that from our politics. We've got all wrapped up like what we want to feel about or how we want to feel about ourselves and who we want to identify with. And same on the Democratic side with a lot of I hear all the time. From a younger generation in particular during the primary, I can't identify with her. It's like, okay, well, if you don't like her policies, I understand that. But, these are not supposed to be our friends. But I think it isn't even friendship. I think it's this idea that this person is an extension of my expression. So that has to be decoupled somehow.
Let me ask, there's got to be others with questions. How did you leave it with your father? And what was your own mix of emotions and affections and devotion to this parent?
Well, I'd like to say that, we walked into the sunset and there was closure and, let the healing begin and all that, but that's not how the world works, and we had a lot of, we continued to have ups and downs, and toward the end, my father became very ill, and he had sort of long-standing heart problems that manifested as a kind of vascular dementia, there was, a whole struggle of convincing him to accept care. And tragically, my father, I saw this sort of path with my father from in the beginning. My father was very preoccupied with the gender transformation, and toward the end, my father had really turned back to thinking about her Jewish identity. And then when the dementia set in, my father, and this is, something that horribly happens to a good number of Holocaust survivors who wind up with dementia or Alzheimer's or some kind, that her hallucinations were often about Nazis coming into the house and her. But back to my relationship with my father. I mean, toward the very end, my father, while we were sitting in the synagogue one day, apologized for a particular act of violence that that she had perpetrated on me, and when I was a child, and which I took as a more of a global apology, and And after a sort of battle we had over my trying to get her to accept home health care and her refusing, and then she kind of threw me out of the house. And then the next day, when I came back and we sort of made up, and she said, well, you know, whatever happens, I know, you know, you are my family, which sounds like a really small thing, but it was, given where my father and I started, it was huge for me.
Susan, thank you. It's a wonderful book. How are you doing for time? And would love questions from this wonderful audience.
I would like to know if there was some kind of epiphany for your father when he decided to become she.
If there was some kind of epiphany. You know, I asked my father that along with many other questions. My father was probably my most challenging journalistic project. Because she, like in every other aspect of her life, she would say, well, maybe it's this or maybe it's that. She was always doing that, you know, kind of dodge and bob thing. I don't think it was so much an epiphany as a sort of final decision. Okay, I'm just going to go throw myself into, I'm just going to do this. I mean, from what I was able to pull out of my father, this was some, you know, the sense of and desire to be a woman dated way back to childhood. And, you know, my father recalled dressing in my grandmother's clothes when my father was, you know, 7, 8, 9. So I think that, you know, the desire was always there. How my father perceived womanhood and what my father wanted out of womanhood, that had more to do with her own life experiences, when she grew up, and particularly what she wanted out of being a woman. I think, you know, part of it was wanting to be loved. I think part of it was wanting a kind of absolution from the sins of her violent male past, wanting to be in connection with other people. So all that was sort of layered on top of what was, you know, just probably a fundamental part of her nature from an early time.
Please.
Hi. This might be hard to talk about, but after you reconnected with your father, wrote this book, Father Die, what changed in your own feeling about your own identity?
That is a good question. What changed in my own identity? Identity, you know, as I was saying before, how we kind of define it these days in ways that are, I don't know, almost egocentric about, well, this is, you know, my identity that I have kind of honed and it's individual to me and I've sort of chosen it and it's internal. You know, I create my own identity, and that's sort of something that's celebrated and kind of celebrated among, you know, in a certain kind of feminism, that kind of you go girl feminism, you go out there and make your own reality. And through this experience, which was, you know, in many ways, you know, as Chris was saying, this isn't so much a memoir as it's kind of a reported, I mean, I didn't actually remember any of these things.
Exactly.
I had to go research them. And so finding out about my family's past and going to see, you know, my family and, you know, who were far flung from Australia to Israel to Switzerland to the Czech Republic, I reconnected me with a whole history that I had not known, and brought back to me the realization that, you know, identity is not just what you're generating, but all of these external collective connections that shape you, whether you know about them or not. And so, I mean, I think ultimately it gave me a deeper connection and understanding of where I came from and therefore, you know, who I am.
When you got that email after many years, and I assume after estrangement and resentment, did you know immediately you were going to go and write his story? What was the thought process? Was it curiosity? Was it reclaiming the love? And then if you just talk a little bit about your mother, is she alive? If she wasn't, what would she have thought about this? What was her reaction to all this? And what was their marriage like?
Wonderful.
Yeah, well, their marriage was clearly not very happy, right? I mean, my father, you know, we were all basically afraid of my father, who could kind of blow at any moment. And, you know, my father was playing the sort of consummate patriarch. You know, which, looking back, I wonder if that was also, you know, just it was unclear to me how much that was just another role. I mean, he sort of felt had to put on this kind of carapace of hyper-masculinity. So, I mean, that was another kind of hiding. And toward the end of my parents' marriage, he was very violent, and my mother had enough of it. Forbade my mother to work. I mean, it was all this kind of, you know, post-war American, I'm the king of my quarter acre, you know, palace. My own reaction, you know, I remember that day after I got the email, I was going to classical music concert. It was a Schnitke's Requiem for his mother. And I was sitting there actually with a couple of friends, one of whom was somebody who had escaped, a Jewish who had escaped from Germany during the Holocaust. It just so happened. So that was another odd wrinkle. But I was sitting there listening to this music, which was very dissonant and sort of, you know, and very much an expression of kind of out of control grief for a lost parent. And I was just overwhelmed with the sense that I, you know, in some way I had let my father down, and that I had kind of bought into this stock script about who my father was, and I stuck to it all these years. And with the news of this email, I thought, you know, I thought I had my father pegged, and in fact, I didn't know the first thing.
Was the Schnitke experience before or after you researched the story?
Oh, no, this is the day, this is the night after I got the email. So this was,
wow.
You know, I'd received,
wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Another example of how you don't really need fiction for some
Amazing.
Stories.
James.
Thanks, Chris. So I came here because I got sort of the street-level abstracts about your book, and I read the snippet. It just seemed a little coincidental, but also timely and so rich in an era of just a lot of memoirs. So I'm part of a dwindling kinship. My father escaped the Holocaust with his father, Czechoslovakia. His family decimated. No one was left, maybe a sixth removed cousin. And you've brought up this Pandora's box of identity, and he never talked about it. And I'm jealous, envious that you at least got to get some details, because for me it was morsels. And as I've gotten older, these morsels have been proved wrong and incorrect. It's just such a blurry thing because my father never talked about it. But one of the things that's come out from, pardon the length of this, from your these abstracts is that your father was kind of brutal, and maybe brutal even in his new identity. And that's what I struggle with myself, because my grandfather brought my father to this country to be just horrible to him. Hmm. And my father became a person who tried to please a man who was unpleasable and never really although a genius in his field, never felt comfortable in that field or in the, you know, sort of, you know, marriage, children, suburbs life that was given to him. And there was always this thing underneath the surface that was never talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And when I would come to him as a child and say problems of a six-year-old, he'd say, well, you're not in a foxhole with dogs and Nazis barking at you.
Oh, geez.
And I'm like, well, that's kind of emotional abuse too, but that's mm-hmm. all I heard. I didn't hear about the stories. And even when he got a Fulbright grant to go back to, went to Holland, he went back to Czechoslovakia in 81, went to the school, went to the apartment, went to the squares, talked about it, but he wouldn't give me that information.
Mm-hmm.
But at least even literally around the corner from here on the Commonwealth Mall, with the urgency of cancer, was able to say to me, I'm proud of you, good thing you never listened to me. But I did, actually. But then there's this, so I guess my question, long roundabout way of going about it, that's me, is why would somebody bring someone to this country and not want to make them free from that tyrant dictatorship and threat, when it's kind of always there
mm-hmm.
As a survivor's child? Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I so relate to your story. I mean, when I was growing up, my father would just, you know, offer these little shards of experience, and, you know, they were like these little flares that would go up, and you could see something for a moment, and then when I would press, you know, to ask, you know, to get more details, my father would immediately shut down. And, you know, I think this is a common experience with the Holocaust survivors, and it's also a common experience with that, you know, that whole silent generation of World War II. I mean, in my neighborhood, I was surrounded, you know, my suburban New York neighborhood, surrounded by, you know, silent fathers who were not immigrants, but they were just, you know, men who, you know, a lot of them had come back from World War II. They had like an old, you know, they kept their, you know, some old weaponry or
their Eisenhower jackets.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And they were quiet and angry, and, you know, once a week, some of them would, like, you know, take out the belt and beat up, you know, one of their, you know, their son for some indiscretion and or not even, you know, some misdemeanor. And I mean, that is so much of what this generation have inherited.
Mm.
And, you know, I like to think that we're you know, that with that knowledge and the kind of knowledge you have, that we're trying to do it differently. But I think it's, you know, I mean, this is one of the great gifts of my father letting me back in to her life at a later age. I mean, it's kind of every adult child's fantasy that this person you've been, you know, who you've been incarcerated with all your life, but you don't really know, that they're finally going to tell you something. So that was a great gift for me.
Mm.
So I wanted to ask the question. You talk mostly, your book is about gender identity, and you hinted a little about Jewish identity. So in context, I'm also Hungarian Jewish, child of Holocaust survivors.
We're everywhere.
Your description of Gestern Yapita that my father used to make at home, and I was blessed and privileged that both my parents talked a lot about it, so I knew their experience.
But that's great.
She sort of explained that after the war, the identification with Judaism kind of went two ways. You were either extremely Orthodox or you lost all faith that there was anyone. So I'm wondering how the Jewish identity played with, I mean, was that a rediscovery too, and never identified as Jewish again? Or where did that all come?
Yeah. And your parents stayed in Hungary after the war, or they were?
No, they went. Yeah. They actually met in. My mother was 13 when she was in Auschwitz, and my father was in a slave labor camp, and they met in displaced persons camp.
Mm.
Wow. Because you know, in Hungary, so after the war, when, you know, Hungary became communist, then religion in general was suppressed. And so there's this whole phenomenon in Hungary where, I mean, on top of that, that if you, you know, were a Holocaust survivor in Hungary in the communist era, it seemed the, you know, better part of wisdom to just not talk about religion at all. So there was this whole generation that grew up having really no idea that they were Jewish. And these sociologists in the late 80s did this big study in Hungary of the children of generation, and what they found over and over again, when the kids grew up having no idea, and then usually found out because they would come home and make some crack about, oh, so-and-so who was, you know, pushing me, or, you know, or so-and-so who we don't like on the playground. Well, that kid's a dirty Jew. And the parent would say, go look in the mirror, you know, that's your dirty Jew. I heard stories like this over and over again when I was in Hungary. And with this sociological study they did, they came up with this term for it, which was like how I discovered that I'm a Jew. And with the fall of communism, there was in the beginning this sort of moment of like, oh, okay, now will be there can be a kind of at least cultural renaissance of Jewish expression. And and there was actually this event where people were received these invitations to come to an event. Then it was a coming out as Jewish event, and all these people who thought nobody knew they were Jewish, right, were invited to this, and rather prominent people. And there was this sort of little hopeful moment, which quickly got snuffed out immediately once the lid was taken off, a lot, you know, the anti-Semitism came back. And now it's in full force. It's pretty shocking.
Hmm. Please.
I wanted to thank you for this. There's so many threads here, and it's been really a thought-provoking conversation. The way that you introduced this, I think you said your father wanted to give up this macho identity. And I thought, what if a lot of men wanted to give that up without having to go through this kind of change? I mean, I just wondered about that because of all the things that you said about identity. And it made me wonder why he had chosen that to be that kind of man in the first place. Mm-hmm. And then chose to try to get rid of at least some of that macho-ness, because you could explain it by all the, you know, historical factors mm-hmm. that contributed, and familial probably, and all sorts of things. But lots of people go through lots of things and don't, it's not an equation that, you know, you go through this and you end up like that.
Right.
So I just was wondering if you had any thoughts about why he was that kind of man and then decided to try to break with that.
Yeah. Well, that is a kind of $64,000 question, which you won't be surprised I don't have the $64,000 answer to. That, you know, my father told me that she felt very weak as a boy, that that she felt she couldn't, you know, sort of, she couldn't play the role, is how she always put it. And so I think there was a lot of compensatory behavior going on. When I was growing up, my father was always this kind of frenetic sportsman and always with the costume to match. You know, so for a while there, he was like horseback riding and had the whole regalia, and then there was rock climbing and ice climbing, and we bicycled across the Alps. I mean, one benefit of this is since I was the older child and my brother didn't come along for 7 years, I got to be sort of the aide-de-camp on all this. So at the same time, my father was kind of forcing himself into this macho role. The one side benefit was that he allowed his daughter to come along and do these kind of, you know, manly man things too. But there is that whole question of, well, could my father have done this without going the full step to sex reassignment surgery? And I can't answer that question because clearly it was something that my father deeply felt she needed. And also my father and I weren't talking in those years that led up to the surgery. I do know that it did give my father permission in her mind to then let some of that down. Although, I mean, she did go to this extreme right after of this kind of caricature girly girl 1950s femininity, which she dropped after a few years. And I often wondered if that was sort of almost the cudgel she needed to break apart the carapace of the hyper-masculine costume she had put on herself all those years. And then only then could she just let that all fall away and just be idiosyncratically herself.
Hmm. Last question, please.
What does your brother think of the book?
Oh, well, my father asked me to write her story, and my brother and my mother did not. So I showed them both the manuscript, and we talked endlessly about, you know, this whole transformation of my father and what it meant, and I incorporated a lot of their changes in the book. But I want to honor their privacy. One problem I have with memoirs is that it's really, you know, it's hard to write a memoir about, one member of the family without invading everybody else's privacy. So I've done, you know, I've tried my best to sort of honor and respect their stories, which are their stories, and I hope they'll tell them sometime.
Thank you, Susan Brody.
Thank you.
Really terrific.
Thank
Just
you.
Terrific. Really
Thank
wonderful.
You.
Thank you.